Chapter 30. Burnin. Hetty stood sufficiently in awe of her aunt to be anxious to conceal from her so much of her vanity as could be hidden without too great a sacrifice. She could not resist spending her money in bits of finery which Mrs. Poyser disapproved, but she would have been ready to die with shame, vexation, and fright if her aunt at this moment opened the door and seen her with her bits of candle lighted and strutting about decked in her scarf and earrings. To prevent such a surprise, she always bolted her door, and she had not forgotten to do so tonight. It was well, for there now came a light tap, and Hetty, with a leaping heart, rushed to blow out the candles and throw them into the drawer. She dared not stay to take out her earrings, but she threw off her scarf and let it fall on the floor before the light tap came again. We shall know how it was that the light tap came if we leave Hetty for a short time and return to Dinah at the moment when S.E. had delivered Toddy to her mother's arms and was come upstairs to her bedroom adjoining Hetty's. Dinah delighted in her bedroom window. Being on the second story of that tall house, it gave her a wide view over the fields. The thickness of the wall formed a broad step about a yard below the window, where she could place her chair. And now the first thing she did on entering her room was to seat herself in this chair and look out on the peaceful fields beyond which the large moon was rising, just above the hedgerow elms. She liked the pasture best, where the milch cows were lying, and next to that the meadow where the grass was half mown, and lay in silvered sweeping lines. Her heart was very full, for there was to be only one more night on which she would look out on those fields for a long time to come, but she thought little of leaving the mere scene, for, to her, bleak snowfields had just as many charms. She thought of all the dear people whom S.E. had learned to care for among these peaceful fields, and who would now have a place in her loving remembrance forever. She thought of the struggles and the weariness that might lie before them in the rest of their life's journey, when she would be away from them, and know nothing of what was befalling them, and the pressure of this thought soon became too strong for her to enjoy the unresponding stillness of the moonlit fields. She closed her eyes, that she might feel more intensely the presence of a love and sympathy deeper and more tender than was breathed from the earth and sky. That was often Dinah's mode of praying in solitude. Simply to close her eyes, and to feel herself enclosed by the divine presence. Then gradually her fears, her yearning anxieties for others, melted away like ice crystals in a warm ocean. S.E. had sat in this way perfectly still, with her hands crossed on her lap, and the pale light resting on her calm face, for at least 10 minutes, when she was startled by a loud sound, apparently of something falling in Hetty's room. But like all sounds that fall on our ears, in a state of abstraction, it had no distinct character, but was simply loud and startling, so that she felt uncertain whether S.E. had interpreted it rightly. She rose and listened, but all was quiet afterwards, and she reflected that Hetty might merely have knocked something down in getting into bed. She began slowly to undress, but now, owing to the suggestions of this sound, her thoughts became concentrated on Hetty, that sweet young thing, with life and all its trials before her, the solemn daily duties of the wife and mother, and her mind, so unprepared for them all, bent merely on little foolish, selfish pleasures, like a child hugging its toys in the beginning of a long toilsome journey in which it will have to bear hunger and cold and unsheltered darkness. Dinah felt a double care for Hetty, because she shared Seth's anxious interest in his brother's lot, and as he had not come to the conclusion that Hetty did not love Adam well enough to marry him. She saw too clearly the absence of any warm, self-devoting love in Hetty's nature to regard the coldness of her behavior towards Adam as any indication that he was not the man she would like to have for a husband. And this blank in Hetty's nature, instead of exciting Dinah's dislike, only touched her with a deeper pity. The lovely face and form affected her as beauty always affects a pure and tender mind, free from selfish jealousies. It was an excellent divine gift that gave a deeper pathos to the need, the sin, the sorrow with which it was mingled, as the canker in a lily white bud is more grievous to behold than in a common pot herb. By the time Dinah had undressed and put on her nightgown, this feeling about Hetty had gathered a painful intensity. Her imagination had created a thorny thicket of sin and sorrow, in which she saw the poor thing struggling, torn and bleeding, looking with tears for rescue and finding none. It was in this way that Dinah's imagination and sympathy acted and reacted habitually, each heightening the other. She felt a deep longing to go now and pour into Hetty's ear all the words of tender warning and appeal that rushed into her mind. But perhaps Hetty was already asleep. Dinah put her ear to the partition and heard still some slight noises, which convinced her that Hetty was not yet in bed. Still she hesitated. She was not quite certain of a divine direction. The voice that told her to go to Hetty seemed no stronger than the other voice which said that Hetty was weary, and that going to her now in an unseasonable moment would only tend to close her heart more obstinately. Dinah was not satisfied without a more unmistakable guidance than those inward voices. There was light enough for her, if she opened her Bible, to discern the text sufficiently to know what it would say to her. She knew the physiognomy of every page, and could tell on what book she opened, sometimes on what chapter, without seeing title or number. It was a small, thick Bible, worn quite round at the edges. Dinah laid it sideways on the window ledge, where the light was strongest, and then opened it with her forefinger. The first words she looked at were those at the top of the left-hand page: colon, and they all wept sore, and fell on Paul's neck and kissed him. That was enough for Dinah, as he had opened on that memorable parting at Ephesus, when Paul had felt bound to open his heart in a last exhortation and warning. She hesitated no longer, but, opening her own door gently, went and tapped on Hetty's. We know as he had to tap twice, because Hetty had to put out her candles and throw off her black lace scarf. But after the second tap, the door was opened immediately. Dinah said, "Will you let me come in, Hetty?" And Hetty, without speaking, for she was confused and vexed, opened the door wider and let her in. What a strange contrast the two figures made, visible enough in that mingled twilight and moonlight. Hetty, her cheeks flushed and her eyes glistening from her imaginary drama, her beautiful neck and arms bare, her hair hanging in a curly tangle down her back, and the baubles in her ears. Dinah, covered with her long white dress, her pale face full of subdued emotion, almost like a lovely corpse into which the soul has returned charged with sublimer secrets and a sublimer love. They were nearly of the same height, Dinah evidently a little the taller, as she put her arm round Hetty's waist and kissed her forehead. "I knew you were not in bed, my dear," she said, in her sweet clear voice, which was irritating to Hetty, mingling with her own peevish vexation like music with jangling chains, "for I heard you moving, and I longed to speak to you again tonight, for it is the last but one that I shall be here, and we don't know what may happen tomorrow to keep us apart. Shall I sit down with you while you do up your hair?" "Oh yes," said Hetty, hastily turning round and reaching the second chair in the room, glad that Dinah looked as if she did not notice her earrings. Dinah sat down, and Hetty began to brush together her hair, before twisting it up, doing it with that air of excessive indifference which belongs to confused self-consciousness. But the expression of Dinah's eyes gradually relieved her. They seemed unobservant of all details. "Dear Hetty," she said, "it has been borne in upon my mind tonight that you may someday be in trouble. Trouble is appointed for us all here below, and there comes a time when we need more comfort and help than the things of this life can give. I want to tell you that, if ever you are in trouble and need a friend that will always feel for you and love you, you have got that friend in Dinah Morris at Snowfield, and if you come to her or send for her, she'll never forget this night and the words she is speaking to you now. Will you remember it, Hetty?" "Yes," said Hetty, rather frightened. "But why should you think I shall be in trouble?" Do you know of anything? Hetty had seated herself as she tied on her cap, and now Dinah leaned forwards and took her hands as she answered. Because, dear, trouble comes to us all in this life. We set our hearts on things which it isn't God's will for us to have, and then we go sorrowing. The people we love are taken from us, and we can joy in nothing because they are not with us. Sickness comes, and we faint under the burden of our feeble bodies. We go astray and do wrong, and bring ourselves into trouble with our fellow men. There is no man or woman born into this world to whom some of these trials do not fall, and so I feel that some of them must happen to you. And I desire for you, that while you are young you should seek for strength from your heavenly Father, that you may have a support which will not fail you in the evil day. Dinah paused and released Hetty's hands, that she might not hinder her. Hetty sat quite still. She felt no response within herself to Dinah's anxious affection. But Dinah's words, uttered with solemn pathetic distinctness, affected her with a chill fear. Her flush had died away almost to paleness. She had the timidity of a luxurious pleasure-seeking nature, which shrinks from the hint of pain. Dinah saw the effect, and her tender anxious pleading became the more earnest, till Hetty, full of a vague fear that something evil was some time to befall her, began to cry. It is our habit to say that, while the lower nature can never understand the higher nature commands a complete view of the lower. But I think the higher nature has to learn this comprehension, as we learn the art of vision, by a good deal of hard experience, often with bruises and gashes incurred in taking things up by the wrong end, and fancying our space wider than it is. Dinah had never seen Hetty affected in this way before, and, with her usual benignant hopefulness, she trusted it was the stirring of a divine impulse. She kissed the sobbing thing, and began to cry with her for grateful joy. But Hetty was simply in that excitable state of mind in which there is no calculating what turn the feelings may take from one moment to another, and for the first time she became irritated under Dinah's caress. She pushed her away impatiently, and said, with a childish sobbing voice, "Don't talk to me so, Dinah. Why do you come to frighten me? I've never done anything to you. Why can't you let me be?" Poor Dinah felt a pang. She was too wise to persist, and only said mildly, "Yes, my dear, you're tired. I won't hinder you any longer. Make haste and get into bed. Good night." She went out of the room almost as quietly and quickly as if she had been a ghost. But once by the side of her own bed, she threw herself on her knees and poured out in deep silence all the passionate pity that filled her heart. As for Hetty, she was soon in the wood again, her waking dreams being merged in a sleeping life scarcely more fragmentary and confused. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.